Chapter 11 Liar. The Commandant of Blackcliff Military Academy. My curiosity for the spy mission withers. The Empire trains the masks at Blackcliff. Masks like the one who murdered my family and stole my brother. The school sprawls atop Sarah's eastern cliffs like a colossal vulture, a jumble of austere buildings enclosed by a black granite wall. No one knows what happens behind that wall, how the masks train, how many there are, how they are chosen. Every year, a new class of masks leaves Blackcliff, young, savage, and deadly. For a scholar, especially a girl, Blackcliff is the most dangerous place in the city. Mazin goes on.
She lost a personal slave. The girl threw herself off the cliffs a week ago,
Keenan retorts, defying Mazin's glare.
She's the third slave to die in the Commandant's service this year. Quiet, Mazin says. I won't lie to you, liar. The woman's unpleasant. She's insane, Keenan says. They call her the Bitch of Blackcliff. You won't survive the Commandant. The mission will fail.
Mazin's fist comes down on the table. Keenan doesn't flinch.
If you can't keep your mouth shut, the resistance leader growls, then leave.
Tarek's jaw drops as he looks between the two men. Sana, meanwhile, watches Keenan with a thoughtful expression. Others in the cabin stare too, and I get the feeling that Keenan and Mazin don't disagree very often. Keenan scrapes his chair back and leaves the table, disappearing into the muttering crowd behind Mazin.
You're perfect for the job, liar, Mazin says. You have all the skills the Commandant would expect from a house slave. She'll assume you're illiterate, and we have the means to get you in.
What happens if I'm caught?
You're dead.
Mazin looks me straight in the eye, and I feel a bitter appreciation for his honesty.
Every spy we've sent to Blackcliff has been discovered and killed. This isn't a mission for the faint-hearted.
I almost want to laugh. He couldn't have picked a worse person for it. You're not doing a very good job selling it.
I don't have to sell it, Mazin says. We can find your brother and break him out. You can be our eyes and ears in Blackcliff. A simple exchange.
You trust me to do this? I ask. You hardly know me.
I knew your parents. That's enough for me. Mazin, Tarek speaks up. She's just a girl. Surely we don't need to... She invoked Izzat, Mazin says. But Izzat means more than freedom. It means more than honor. It means courage. It means proving yourself.
He's right, I say. If the resistance is going to help me, I can't have the fighters thinking I'm weak. A glimmer of red catches my eye, and I look across the cabin to where Keenan leans against a bunk watching me, his hair like fire in the torchlight. He doesn't want me to take this mission because he doesn't want to risk the men to save Darren. I put a hand to my armlet. Be brave, liar. I turn to Mazin. If I do this, you'll find Darren. You'll break him out of jail.
You have my word. It won't be hard to locate him. He's not a resistance leader, so it's not as if they'll send him to Koff.
Mazin snorts, but mention of the infamous northern prison sends a chill across my skin. Koff's interrogators have one goal, to make inmates suffer as much as possible before they die. My parents died in Koff. My sister, only 12 at the time, died there too.
By the time you make your first report, Mazin says, I'll be able to tell you where Darren is. When your mission is complete, we'll break him out.
And after?
We pry your slave's cuffs off and pull you out of the school. We can make it look like a suicide, so you're not hunted. You can join us if you like. Or we can arrange passage to Marin for you both.
Marin. The Free Lands. What I wouldn't give to escape there with my brother, to To live in a place with no marshals, no masks, no empire. But first, I have to survive a spy mission. I have to survive Blackcliff. Across the cabin, Keenan shakes his head. But the fighters around me nod. This is Izzat, they seem to say. I fall silent, as if considering. But my decision is made the second I realize that going to Blackcliff is the only way to get Darren back. I'll do it.
Good.
Mazin doesn't sound surprised, and I wonder if he knew all along that I would say yes. He raises his voice so it carries.
Keenan will be your handler.
At this, the younger man's face goes, if possible, even darker. He presses his lips together as if to keep from speaking.
Her hands and feet are cut up, Mazin says. See to her injuries, Keenan, and tell her what she needs to know. She leaves for Blackcliff tonight.
Mazin leaves, trailed by members of his faction, while Tarik claps me on the shoulder and wishes me luck. His allies pepper me with advice. Never go looking for your handler. Don't trust anyone. They only wish to help. But it's overwhelming, and when Keenan cuts through the crowd to retrieve me, I'm almost relieved. Almost. He jerks his head to a table in the corner of the cabin and walks off without waiting for me. A glint of light near the table turns out to be a small spring. Keenan fills two tubs with water and a powder I recognize as tanroot. He sets one tub on the table and one on the floor. I scrub my hands and feet clean, wincing as the tanroot sinks into the scrapes I picked up in the catacombs. Keenan watches silently. Beneath his scrutiny, I am ashamed at how quickly the water turns black with muck, and then angry at myself for being ashamed. When I'm done, Keenan sits at the table across from me and takes my hands. I'm expecting him to be brusque, but his hands are not gentle exactly, but not callous either. As he examines my cuts, I think of a dozen questions I could ask him, none of which will make him think that I'm strong and capable instead of childish and petty. Why do you seem to hate me? What did I do to you?
You shouldn't be doing this.
He rubs a numbing ointment on one of the deeper cuts, keeping his attention fixed on my wounds.
This mission.
You've made that clear, you jackass. I won't let Mazin down. I'll do what I have to.
You'll try, I'm sure.
I'm stung at his bluntness, though by now it should be clear that he has no faith in me.
The woman's a savage. The last person we sent in.
Do you think I want to spy on her? I burst out. He looks up, surprise in his eyes. I don't have a choice. Not if I want to save the only family I have left. So just... shut it, I want to say. Just don't make this harder. Something like embarrassment crosses his face, and he regards me with a tiny bit less scorn. I'm...
sorry.
His words are reluctant, but a reluctant apology is better than none at all. I nod jerkily and realize that his eyes are not blue or green, but a deep chestnut brown. You're noticing his eyes, Lyra, which means you're staring into them, which means you need to stop. The smell of the salve stings my nostrils and I wrinkle my nose. Are you using twin thistle in this salve? I ask. At his shrug, I pull the bottle from him and take another sniff. Try zebra next time. It doesn't smell like goat dung, at least. Keenan raises a fiery eyebrow and wraps one of my hands with gauze.
You know your remedies. Useful skill. Your grandparents were healers.
My grandfather? It hurts to speak of Pop, and I pause a long while before going on. He started training me formally a year and a half ago. I mixed his remedies before that.
Do you like it? Healing?
It's a trade. Most scholars who aren't enslaved work menial jobs, as farmhands or cleaners or stevedores. Back-breaking labor for which they're paid next to nothing. I'm lucky to have one, though when I was little, I wanted to be a Kihani. Keenan's mouth curves into the barest smile. It is a small thing, but it transforms his entire face and lightens the weight on my chest. "A tribal tailspinner," he says. "Don't tell me you believe in myths of djinn and ifrits and wraiths that kidnap children in the night." "No," I think of the raid, of the mask. My lightness melts away. "I don't need to believe in the supernatural. Not when there's worse that roams the night." He goes still, a sudden stillness that draws my eyes up and into his. My breath hitches as what I see laid bare in his gaze. A wrenching knowledge, a bitter understanding of pain that I know well. He's someone who has walked paths as dark as mine. Darker, maybe. Then coldness descends over his face, and his hands are moving again. "Right," he says. "Listen carefully. Today was graduation day at Blackcliff, but we've just learned that this year's ceremony was different. Special." He tells me of the trials and the four aspirants. Then he gives me my mission. "We need three pieces of information. We need to know what each trial is, where it's taken place, and when. And we need to know this before each trial begins, not after." I have a dozen questions, but I don't ask, knowing he'll just think me more foolish. "How long will I be in the school?" Keenan shrugs and finishes bandaging my hands. "We know next to nothing about the trials," he says, "but I can't imagine it will take more than a few weeks. A month, at most."
Do you think Darren will last that long?"
Keenan doesn't answer. Hours later in the early evening, I find myself in a house in the foreign quarter with Keenan and Sana standing before an elderly tribesman. He's clad in the loose robes of his people and looks more like a kindly old uncle than a resistance operative. When Sana explains what she wants of him, he takes one look at me and folds his arms across his chest.
"Absolutely not," he says in heavily accented Saren. "The Commandant will eat her alive."
Keenan throws Sana a pointed look as if to say, "What did you expect?" "With respect," Sana says to the tribesman. "Can we..." She gestures to a lattice screen doorway leading to another room. They disappear behind the lattice. Sana's speaking too softly for me to hear, but whatever she's saying must not be working, because even through the screen, I can see the tribesman shaking his head.
"He won't do it," I say.
Beside me, Keenan leans against the wall, unconcerned.
"Sana can convince him. She's not leader of her faction for nothing."
"I wish I could do something."
"Try looking a little braver."
"What? Like you?"
I arrange my face so it's blank as slate, slump against the wall, and look off into the distance. Keenan actually smiles for a fraction of a second. It takes years off his face. I rather barefoot across the hypnotic swirls of the thick tribal rug on the floor. Pillows embroidered with tiny mirrors are strewn across it, and lamps of coloured glass hang from the roof, catching the last rays of sunlight.
"Darren and I came to a house like this to sell Nan's jams once."
I reach up to touch one of the lamps.
"I asked him why tribesmen have mirrors everywhere, and he said..."
The memory is clear and sharp in my mind, and an ache for my brother, for my grandparents, pulses in my chest with such violence that I clamp my mouth shut. Tribesmen think the mirrors ward off evil, Darren said that day. He took out his sketchbook while we waited for the tribal trader and started drawing, capturing the intricacy of the lattice screens and lanterns with small, quick strokes of charcoal. Jin and wraiths can't stand the sight of themselves, apparently. After that, he He'd answered a dozen more of my questions with his usual quiet confidence. At the time, I'd wondered how he knew so much. Only now do I understand. Darren always listened more than he spoke, watching, learning. In that way, he was like Pop. The ache in my chest expands, and my eyes are suddenly hot.
"It'll get better," Keenan says.
I look up to see sadness flicker across his face, almost instantly replaced by that now familiar chill.
"You'll never forget them, not even after years. But one day, you'll go a whole minute without feeling the pain. Then an hour, a day. That's all you can ask for, really."
His voice drops.
"You'll heal. I promise."
He looks away, distant again. But I'm grateful to him anyway, because for the first time since the raid, I feel less alone. A second later, Sana and the tribesmen come around the screen.
"You're sure this is what you want?"
the tribesman asks me. I nod, not trusting my voice.
He sighs. "Very well."
He turns to Sana and Keenan.
"Say your goodbyes. If I take her now, I can still get her into the school by dark."
"You'll be all right." Sana hugs me tightly, and I wonder if she's trying to convince me or herself. "You're the lioness's daughter, and the lioness was a survivor." Until she wasn't. I lower my gaze so Sana doesn't see my doubt. She heads out the door, and then Keenan is before me. I cross my arms, not wanting him to think I need a hug from him too. But he doesn't touch me, just cocks his head and lifts his fist to his heart. The resistance salute.
"Death before tyranny,"
he says. Then he, too, is gone. A half hour later, dusk drops over the city of Serra, and I am following the tribesmen swiftly through the Makeda Quarter, home to the wealthiest members of the martial merchant class. We stop before the ornate iron gate of a slaver's home, and the tribesman checks my manacles, his tan robes swishing softly as he moves around me. I clasp my bandaged hands together to stop them from shaking, but the tribesman gently pries my fingers apart.
"Slavers catch lies the way spiders catch flies," he says. "Your fear is good. It makes your story real. Remember, do not speak."
I nod vigorously. Even if I wanted to say something, I'm too frightened. The slaver is Blackcliff's sole supplier, Keenan had explained while walking me to the tribesman's house. It's taken months for our operative to gain his trust. If he doesn't pick you for the commandant, your mission's dead before it begins. We're escorted through the gates, and moments later, the slaver is circling me, sweating in the heat. He's as tall as the tribesman, but twice as broad, with a paunch that strains the buttons of his gold brocade shirt.
"Not bad,"
the slaver snaps his fingers, and a slave girl appears from the recesses of his mansion bearing a tray of drinks. The slaver slurps one down, pointedly not offering anything to the tribesman.
"The brothels will pay well for her. As a whore, she won't fetch more than 100 marks,
the tribesman says in his hypnotic lilt.
"I need 200.
The slaver snorts, and I want to strangle him for it. The shaded streets of his neighborhood are littered with sparkling fountains and bow-backed scholar slaves. The man's house is a bloated hodgepodge of arches and columns and courtyards. 200 silvers is a drop in the bucket for him. He probably paid more for the plaster lions flanking his front door.
"I hoped to sell her as a house slave," the tribesman continues. "I heard you were looking for one."
"I am," the slaver admits. "Commandant's been on my back for days. Hag keeps killing off her girls. Temper like a viper."
The slaver eyes me the way a rancher eyes a heifer, and I hold my breath. Then
He shakes his head.
She's too small, too young, too pretty. She won't last a week in Blackcliff, and I don't want the bother of replacing her. I'll give you 100 for her and sell her to Madame Mo over Dockside.
A bead of sweat trickles down the tribesman's otherwise serene face. Mazin ordered him to do whatever it took to get me into Blackcliff. But if he drops his price suddenly, the slaver will be suspicious. If he sells me as a whore, the resistance will have to get me out. And there is no guarantee they can do so quickly. If he doesn't sell me at all, my attempt to save Darin will fail. Do something, liar, Darin again, fanning my courage. Or I'm dead. I press clothes well, master. The words are out before I can reconsider. The tribesman's mouth drops open, and the slaver regards me as if I'm a rat who has begun juggling. And, I can cook and clean and dress hair. I trail off into a whisper. I'd make a good maid. The slaver stares me down, and I wish I'd kept my mouth shut. Then his eyes grow shrewd, almost amused.
Afraid of whoring, girl?
Don't
see why. It's an honest enough trade.
He circles me again, then jerks my chin up until I am looking into his reptilian green eyes.
You said you can dress hair and press clothes. Can you barter and handle yourself in the market?
Yes, sir.
You can't read, of course. Can you count?
Of course I can count, and I can read too, you double-chinned pig. Yes, sir. I can count.
She'll have to learn to keep her mouth shut, the slaver says. I've got to eat the cost of clean-up. Can't send her to Blackcliff looking like a chimney sweep.
He considers.
I'll take her for 150 silver marks. I can always take her to one of the Illustrian houses, the tribesman suggests. Underneath all that dirt, she's a fine-looking girl. I'm sure they'd pay well for her.
The slaver narrows his eyes. I wonder if Mazin's man has erred, trying to bargain higher. Come on, you miser, I think at the slaver. Cough up a little extra. The slaver pulls out a sack of coins. I fight to hide my relief.
180 marks, then. Not a copper more. Take off her chains.
Less than an hour later, I'm locked inside a ghost wagon that is heading for Blackcliff. Wide, silver bands that mark me as a slave adorn each wrist. A chain leads from the collar around my neck to a steel rail inside the wagon. My skin still smarts from the scrubbing I got from two slave girls, and my head aches from the tight bun they tamed my hair into. My dress, black silk with a corset tight bodice and diamond patterned skirt, is the finest thing I've ever worn. I hate it on sight. The minutes crawl by. The inside of the wagon is so dark that I feel as if I've gone blind. The Empire throws scholar children into these wagons, some as young as 2 or 3, ripped screaming from their parents. After that, who knows what happens to them? The ghost wagons are so named because those who disappear into them are never seen again. Don't think of such things, Darin whispers to me. Focus on the mission, and how you'll save me. As I go over Keenan's instructions again in my head, the wagon begins to climb, moving achingly slow. The heat seeps into me, and when I feel as if I'll faint from it, I think up a memory to distract myself. Pop sticking his finger in a fresh jam pot 3 days ago, and laughing while Nan whacked him with a spoon. Their absence is a wound in my chest. I miss Pop's growling laugh and Nan's stories. And Darin, how I miss my brother, his jokes and drawings, and how he seems to know everything. Life without him isn't just empty. It's scary. He's been my guide, my protector, my best friend for so long that
I don't know what to do without him. The thought of him suffering torments me. Is he in a cell right now? Is he being tortured? In the corner of the ghost wagon, something flickers, dark and creeping. I want it to be an animal, a mouse, or skies, even a rat. But then the creature's eyes are on me, bright and ravenous. It is one of the things, one of the shadows from the night of the raid. I'm going crazy, bleeding back crazy. I close my eyes, willing the thing to disappear. When it doesn't, I swat at it with trembling hands. Liar. Go away. You're not real. The thing inches close. Don't scream, liar, I tell myself, biting down hard on my lip. Don't scream. Your brother suffers, liar. Each of the creature's words is deliberate, as if it wants to make sure I don't miss a single one. The marshals pull pain from him slowly and with relish. No, you're in my head. The creature's laugh is like breaking glass. I'm real as death, little liar. Real as shattered bones and traitorous sisters and hateful masks. You're an illusion. You're my guilt. I grab Mother's armlet. The shadow flashes its predator's grin, and now it's only a foot away. But then the wagon comes to a stop, and the creature gives me a last malevolent look before disappearing with a dissatisfied hiss. Seconds later, the wagon door swings open, and the forbidding walls of Black Cliff are before me, their oppressive weight driving the hallucination from my mind.
Eyes down.
The slaver unchains me from the rail, and I force my gaze to the cobbled street.
Only speak to the Commandant if she speaks to you. Don't look her in the eyes. She's flogged slaves for less. When she gives you a task, carry it out quickly and well. She'll disfigure you in the first few weeks, but you'll thank her for it eventually. If the scarring's bad enough, it'll keep the older students from raping you too often. The last slave lasted 2 weeks. The slaver continues, oblivious to my growing terror. Commandant wasn't happy about it. My fault, of course. I should have given the girl some fair warning. Went batty when the Commandant branded her, apparently. Threw herself off the cliffs. Don't you do the same.
He gives me a hard look, like a father warning an errant child not to wander off.
Or the Commandant will think I'm supplying her with inferior goods.
The slaver nods a greeting to the guards stationed at the gates and pulls my chain as if I'm a dog. I shuffle after him. Rape. Disfigurement. Branding. I can't do it, Darren. I can't. A visceral urge to flee sweeps through me, so powerful that I slow, stop, pull away from the slaver. My stomach roils, and I think I'll be sick. But the slaver yanks the chain hard, and I stumble forward. There's nowhere to run, I realize as we pass beneath Blackcliff's iron-spiked portcullis and into the fabled grounds. There's nowhere to go. There's no other way to save Darren. I'm in now, and there is no going back.
Chapter 12. Elias. Hours after I'm named an aspirant, I dutifully stand beside Grandfather in his cavernous foyer to greet guests arriving for my graduation party. Though Quinn Veturius is 77 years old, women blush when he looks them in the eye, and men wince when he deigns to shake their hands. The lamplight paints his thick mane of white hair gold, and the way he towers over everyone else, the way he nods at those entering his home, makes me imagine a falcon watching the world from an updraft. By eighth bell, the mansion is packed with the finest Illustrian families, along with a few of the wealthiest Mercators. The only plebeians are the stable hands. My mother wasn't invited.
Congratulations, Aspirant Veturius.
A moustached man, who might be a cousin, says as he shakes my hand in both of his, using the title the augurs bestowed on me during graduation.
Or should I say, Your Imperial Majesty?
The man dares to meet Grandfather's gaze with an obsequious grin. Grandfather ignores him. It's been like this all night. People whose names I don't know are treating me as if I'm their long-lost son, or brother, or cousin. Half of them probably are related to me, but they've never bothered acknowledging my existence before this. The bootlickers are interspersed with friends. Faris, Dex, Tristus, Leander. But the person I wait most impatiently for is Helene. After I took the oath, the families of the graduates flooded the field, and she was swept away in a tide of Jens Aquila before I had a chance to speak to her. What is she thinking about the trials? Are we competing against each other for emperorship? Or will we work together, as we have since entering Blackcliff? My questions lead to more questions. Most urgently, how becoming the leader of an empire I loathe can possibly result in my attaining true freedom of body and of soul. One thing is certain. As much as I want to escape Blackcliff, the school isn't done with me yet. Instead of a month of leave, we only get 2 days. Then the augurs have demanded that all students, even graduates, return to Blackcliff to serve as witnesses to the trials. When Helene finally arrives at Grandfather's house, parents and sisters in tow, I forget to greet her. I'm too busy staring. She salutes Grandfather, slender and shining in her ceremonials, her black cloak fluttering lightly. Her hair, silver in the candlelight, pours down her back like a river. "Careful, Aquila," I say as she approaches. "You almost look like a girl."
"And you almost look like an aspirant."
Her smile doesn't reach her eyes, and instantly I know something's off. Her earlier elation has evaporated, and she's jittery. The way she is before a battle, she thinks she won't win.
"What's wrong?"
I ask. She tries to get past me, but I take her hand and pull her back. There's a storm in her eyes, but she forces a smile and gently untangles her fingers from mine.
"Nothing's wrong. Where's the food? I'm starving."
"I'll come with you."
"Aspirant Veturius," Grandfather booms. "Governor Leif Tenalius wishes a word."
"Best not keep Quinn waiting," Helene says. "He looks determined."
She slips away, and I grit my teeth as Grandfather coerces me into a stilted discussion with the governor. I repeat the same boring conversation with a dozen other illustrian leaders over the next hour, until at long last, Grandfather steps away from the unending stream of guests and pulls me aside.
"You're distracted when you can ill afford to be," he says. "These men could be very helpful.
Can they take the trials for me?"
"Don't be an idiot,"
Grandfather says in disgust.
"An emperor is not an island. It takes thousands to run the empire effectively. The city governors will report to you, but they'll mislead and manipulate you at every step, so you'll need a spy network to keep them in check. The scholars' resistance, border raiders, and the more troublesome of the tribes will see a change in dynasty as an opportunity to sow disorder. You'll need the full support of the military to put down any hint of rebellion. In short, you need these men as advisors, ministers, diplomats, generals, spy masters."
I nod distractedly. There's a Mercator girl in a tantalizingly flimsy dress, eyeing me from the door leading to the crowded garden. She's pretty. Really pretty. I smile at her. Maybe after I find Helene. Grandfather grabs my shoulder and steers me away from the garden, which I've been inching toward.
"Pay attention, boy," he says. "The drums carried news of the trials to the Emperor this morning. My spies tell me he left the capital as soon as he heard. Thea, most of his house will be here in a matter of weeks. The Bloodshrike, too, if he wants to keep his head." At my look of surprise, Grandfather snorts.
"Did you think Jen's Tyre would go down without a fight?"
"But the Emperor practically worships the Augurs. He visits them every year."
"Indeed. And now they've turned against him by threatening to usurp his dynasty. He'll fight. You can count on it."
Grandfather narrows his eyes.
"If you want to win this, you need to wake up.
I've already wasted too much time cleaning up your messes. The Farrar brothers are telling anyone who will listen that you nearly let a deserter escape yesterday. That your mask not joining with you is a sign of disloyalty. You're lucky the Bloodshrike is in the north. He'd have had you in the stocks by now. As it is, the Blackguard chose not to investigate once I reminded them that the Farrars are low-born plebeian scum, and you're from the finest house in the Empire.
Are you listening to me?"
"Of course I am." I act affronted. But since I'm half eyeing the Mercator girl and half looking into the garden for Helene, Grandfather isn't convinced. "I wanted to find help."
"Don't you dare get distracted by Aquila,"
Grandfather says.
"How she managed to be named aspirant in the first place, I don't understand. Women have no place in the military."
"Aquila's one of the best fighters at the school." At my defense of her, Grandfather slams his hand on an antique entryway table, so hard that a vase falls from it and shatters. The Mercator girl yelps and scurries away. Grandfather doesn't blink.
"Rubbish," Grandfather says. "Don't tell me you have feelings for the wench."
"Grandfather,
she belongs to the Empire, though I suppose if you were named Emperor, you could set her aside as Bloodshrike and marry her instead. She's an illustrian of strong stock, so at least you'd have a passel of heirs."
"Grandfather, stop." I am uncomfortably aware of the heat rising in my neck at the prospect of making heirs with Helene. "I don't think of her like that. She's... Grandfather lifts a silver eyebrow as I stammer like a fool. I am full of it, of course. Students don't get much in the way of women at Blackcliff, unless they rape a slave or pay a whore, neither of which I've ever had any interest in. I've had plenty of diversions during leave, but leave comes once a year. Helene is a girl, a pretty girl, and I spend most of my time around her. Of course I've thought of her in that way. But it doesn't mean anything."
"She's a comrade in arms, Grandfather," I say. "Could you love a fellow soldier the way you loved Grandmother?"
"None of my fellows were tall blonde girls."
"Am I done here? I'd like to celebrate my graduation."
"One more thing."
Grandfather disappears, returning a few moments later with a long package wrapped in black silk.
"These are for you," he says. "I was planning to leave them to you when you became pater of Gens Veturia, but they'll serve you better now."
When I open the package, I nearly drop it.
10 burning hells!
I stare at the Sims in my hands, a matched set with intricate black etchings that probably have no equal in the Empire.
"These are Telemann's Sims."
"Made by the current Telemann's grandfather. Good man. Good friend."
Jens Telemann has produced the most talented Empire smiths for centuries. The current Telemann smith spends months fashioning the mask's Seric steel armor every year. But a Telemann sim, a true Telemann sim, able to cut through 5 bodies at once, is forged every few years, at the most.
I can't take these. I try to give the blades back, but Grandfather plucks my own Sims from where I've slung them on my back and replaces them with the Telemann blades. They are a fitting gift for an emperor, he says. See that you earn them. Always victorious. Always victorious. I echo the Veturia motto, and Grandfather leaves to attend to his guests. Still reeling from the gift, I head to the food tent, hoping to find Helene. Every few feet, people stop to chat with me. Someone shoves a plate of spiced kebabs into my hand. Someone else, a drink. A pair of older masks bemoan the fact that the trials didn't take place in their time, while a group of illustrian generals discuss Emperor Tyus in hushed tones, as if his spies might be watching. No one speaks of the augurs with anything less than reverence. No one would dare. When I finally escape the crowd, Helene's nowhere in sight, though I spot her sisters, Hannah and Livia, eyeing a bored-looking Faris. Veturius, Faris grunts at me, and I'm relieved that he doesn't treat me with the same fawning awe as everyone else. I need you to introduce me. He looks pointedly at a knot of silk-clad, bejeweled illustrian girls, lurking near the edges of the tent, some of whom are watching me in a disturbingly predatory way. I know a few of the girls well. Too well, actually, for all that whispering they're doing to come to any good. Faris, you're a mask. You don't need an introduction. Just go talk to them. If you're that nervous, ask Dex or Demetrius to go with you. Have you seen Helene? He ignores my question. Demetrius didn't come, probably because fun is against his moral code. And Dex is drunk, loosening up for once in his life, thank the skies. What about Trist? Too busy drooling at his fiancée. Faris nods to one of the tables, where Trista sits with Aelia, pretty and black-haired. He looks happier than I've seen him all year. And Leander confessed his love to Helene. Again? Again. She told him to piss off before she broke his nose a second time, and he went looking for solace in the back garden with some redhead. You're my last hope. Faris looks lasciviously at the illustrian girls. If we remind them that you'll be emperor, I bet we could get two each. Now there's a thought. I actually consider this for a moment before remembering Helene. But I have to find Aquila. At that moment, she walks into the tent and past the knot of girls, stopping when one speaks to her. She glances at me before whispering something. The girl's jaw drops open, and Helene turns back around and leaves the tent. I've got to catch Helene, I say to Faris, who has noticed Hannah and Livia, and is smiling invitingly at them while smoothing back his cowlick. Don't get too drunk, I advise. And unless you want to wake up without your manhood, stay away from those two. They're hell's little sisters. The smile drops off Faris's face, and he moves determinedly out of the tent. I hurry after Helene, spotting a flash of blonde heading through Grandfather's vast gardens and toward a rickety shed at the back of the house. The light of the party tent doesn't reach this far, and I have only starlight by which to navigate. I keep my plate, toss my drink, and pull myself atop the shed, one-handed, before clambering onto the sloped roof of the house. You could have picked an easier spot to get to, Aquila. It's quiet up here, she says from the darkness. Plus you can see all the way to the river. Did you bring any for me? Piss off. You probably had two plates while I shook hands with all those stuffed shirts. Mother says I'm too skinny. She spears a pastry off my plate with a dagger. What took you so long to get up here anyway? Paying court to your bevy of maidens? My awkward conversation with Grandfather comes sharply to mind, and a thorny silence descends. Helene and I don't discuss girls. She teases Faris and Dex and the others about their dalliances. But not me. Never me. Would you believe Lavinia Tenalia had the nerve to ask me if you'd ever spoken of her? I about shoved a kebab skewer through that bursting bodice of hers. The barest frisson of tension tinges Helene's voice, and I clear my throat. What did you say to her?
I told her you called out her name every time you visited the dock girls. Shut her right up.
I burst into laughter, understanding now the horrified look on Lavinia's face. Helene smiles, but her eyes are sad. She seems lonely, suddenly. When I tilt my head to capture her gaze, she looks away. Whatever is wrong, she's not ready to tell me. What will you do if you become Empress? I ask. What will you change?
You're going to win, Elias, and I'll be your bloodshrike.
She speaks with such conviction that for a second, it's like she's speaking some old truth, like she is telling me the color of the sky. But then she shrugs and looks away.
But if I won, I'd change everything. Expand trade south. Bring women into the army. Open up relations with the mariners. And I'd do something about the scholars.
You mean the resistance?
No. What happens in the quarter? The raids? The killing? It's not...
I know she wants to say that it's not right, but that would be sedition.
Things could be better, she says.
There's a challenge in her face when she looks at me, and I lift my eyebrows. Helene never struck me as a scholar sympathizer. I like her more for it.
What about you? She asks. What would you do?
Same as you, I guess. I can't tell her that I have no interest in ruling and never will. She won't understand. Maybe I'd just let you run things while I lounged in my harem.
Be serious.
I'm very serious. I grin at her. The Emperor does have a harem, right? Because that's the only reason I took the oath. She shoves me, practically off the roof, and I beg for mercy.
It's not funny.
She sounds like a centurion, and I try to arrange my face in an appropriately sober manner.
Our lives are on the line here, she says. Promise me you'll fight to win. Promise me you'll give the trials everything you've got.
She grabs a strap on my armor.
Promise!
All right, bleeding skies. It was just a joke. Of course I'll fight to win. I'm not planning to die, that's for sure. But what about you? Don't you want to become Empress? She shakes her head vehemently.
I'm better suited to being Bloodshrike. And I don't want to compete with you, Elias. The moment we start working against each other is the moment we let Marcus and Zack win.
Hell. I think to ask her what's wrong again, hoping that all this talk of sticking together will make her want to confide in me. She doesn't give me the chance.
Vittorius!
Her eyes widen when she catches sight of the scabbards on my back.
Are those Telemann blades?
I show her the Sims, and she is appropriately envious. We are quiet for a while after, content to contemplate the stars above us, to find music in the distant sounds that drift up from the forges. I take in her slim body, her lean profile. What would Helene have been if not a mask? It's impossible to imagine her as a typical Illustrian girl, angling for a good match, attending fates and allowing herself to be seduced by fittingly high-born men. I guess it doesn't matter. Whatever we might have been, healers or politicians, jurists or builders, was trained out of us, spun up and away into the funnel of darkness that is Blackcliff.
What's going on with you, Hel?
I say.
Don't insult me by pretending you don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just nervous about the trials.
She doesn't pause or stutter. She looks right into my eyes. Her blue irises clear and mild, her head tilted slightly. Anyone else would believe her without question. But I know Helene, and I know instantly, down in my bones, that she's lying. In another flash of insight, born of the awareness that only makes itself known deep in the night, when the mind opens strange doors, I realize something else. This is not a quiet lie. It is violent and shattering. She sighs at my expression.
Leave it alone, Elias.
So there is something.
Fine, she cuts me off. I'll tell you what's bothering me if you tell me what you were really doing in the tunnels yesterday morning.
The comment is so unexpected that I have to look away from her. I told you, I...
Yes, you said you were looking for the deserter. And I'm saying there's nothing wrong with me. Now it's all clear and in the open.
There is a bite to her voice I'm not used to.
And there's nothing else to talk about.
She meets my gaze, an unfamiliar wariness in her eyes.
What are you hiding, Elias?
Her expression asks. Hell's a master at ferreting out secrets. Something about the combination of her loyalty and patience creates an uncanny urge to confide. She knows, for instance, that I smuggle sheets to the yearlings so they don't get whipped for wetting their beds. She knows I write to Mamie Reeler and my foster brother, Sean, every month. She knows I once dumped a bucket of cow dung on Marcus's bed. She chuckled for days over that one. But there's so much now that she doesn't know. My loathing of the Empire. How desperately I want to be free of it. We aren't kids anymore, laughing over shared confidences. We never will be again. In the end, I don't answer her question. She doesn't answer mine. Instead, we sit without words, watching the city, the river, the desert beyond. Our secrets heavy between us.
Chapter 13. Liar. Despite the slaver's warning to keep my head down, I gaze at the school with sick wonder. Night blends into the grey of the stone until I can't tell where the shadows end and the buildings of Blackcliff begin. Blue fire lamps make even the bare, sand-training fields of the school seem ghostly. In the distance, moonlight glimmers off the columns and arches of a dizzyingly high amphitheatre. Blackcliff students are on leave, and the scrape of my sandals is the only sound to break the sinister quiet of the place. Every hedge is squared as if by a plane. Every path is neatly paved without a crack in sight. There are no flowers or blooming vines crawling up the buildings, no benches where students can relax.
Face forward, the slaver barks. Eyes down!
We head for a structure crouching on the lip of the southern cliffs like a black toad. It's built of the same brooding granite as the rest of the school. The Commandant's house. A sea of sand dunes stretches below the cliffs, lifeless and unforgiving. Far beyond the dunes, the blue jags of the Seren Range cut into the horizon. A diminutive slave girl opens the front door of the house. The first thing I notice is her eye patch. She'll disfigure you in the first few weeks, the slaver had said. Will the Commandant take my eye too? Doesn't matter. I reach for my armlet. It's for Darin. All for Darin. The inside of the house is as gloomy as a dungeon, the smattering of candles providing little illumination against the dark stone walls. I look around, glimpsing the simple, almost monkish furnishings of a dining room and sitting room before the slaver grabs a fistful of my hair and pulls on it so hard I think my neck will break. A knife appears in his hand, its tip caressing my eyelashes. The slave girl winces.
"You look up one more time," the slaver says, his hot breath foul in my face. "I'll carve out your eyes. Understand?"
My eyes water, and at my rapid nod, he releases me.
"Stop blubbering," he says, as the slave leads us upstairs. "Commandant would rather put a sim through you than deal with tears, and I didn't spend 180 marks just to throw your corpse to the vultures."
The slave girl leads us to a door at the end of a hallway, straightening her already perfectly pressed black dress before knocking softly. A voice orders us to enter. As the slaver pushes the door open, I get a glimpse of a heavily curtained window, a desk, and a wall of hand-drawn faces. Then I remember the slaver's knife and pin my eyes to the floor.
"It took you long enough," a soft voice greets us.
"Forgive me, Commandant," the slaver says. "My supplier..."
"Silence."
The slaver swallows. His hands rasp like a snake's coils as he rubs them together. I stand perfectly still. Is the Commandant looking at me? Examining me? I try to look beaten and obedient, the way I know marshals like scholars to look. A second later, she is before me, and I jump, surprised at how silently she's come around her desk. She's smaller than I expect, shorter than me, and reads slim, almost delicate. If not for the mask, I might mistake her for a child. Her uniform is pressed to perfection, and her pants are tucked into mirror-bright black boots. Every button of her ebony shirt gleams with the shimmer of a serpent's eyes.
"Look at me," she says.
I force myself to obey, instantly paralyzed as I meet her gaze. Looking into her face is like looking at the flat, smooth surface of a gravestone. There isn't a shred of humanity in her grey eyes, nor any evidence of kindness in the planes of her masked features. A spiral of faded blue ink curls up the left side of her neck, a tattoo of some kind.
"What is your name, girl?"
"Lyra." My head is jerked to one side, my cheek on fire before I even realize she's struck me. Tears spring to my eyes at the sharpness of the slap, and I dig my nails into my thigh to keep from running.
"Wrong," the Commandant informs me.
"You have no name, no identity. You are a slave. That is all you are. That is all you will ever be." She turns to the slaver to discuss payment. My face is still smarting when the slaver unhooks my collar. Before walking out, he pauses.
"May I offer you my congratulations, Commandant?"
"On what?"
"On the naming of the aspirants. It's all over the city. Your son..."
"Get out,"
the Commandant says. She turns her back on the startled slaver, who quickly retreats and settles her gaze on me. This thing actually spawned. What kind of demon had she whelped? I shudder, hoping I never find out. The silence lengthens, and I remain still as a post, too afraid to even blink. 2 minutes with the Commandant, and she's already cowed me.
"Slave," she says. "Look behind me."
I look up, and the peculiar impression of faces I'd gotten when I first walked in resolves itself. The wall behind the Commandant is covered with wood-framed posters of men and women, old and young. There are dozens, row after row. Wanted, rebel spy, scholar thieves, resistance henchmen, reward 250 marks, 1,000 marks.
These are the faces of every resistance fighter I've hunted down, every scholar I've jailed and executed.
most before my tenure as commandant, some after. A paper cemetery. The woman is sick. I look away. I will tell you the same thing I tell every slave brought into Blackcliff. The resistance has tried to